From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is.
This is.
This is.
This is War News Radio. In our last episode, we discussed the history and the background behind the current persecution of the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Military violence against this minority group has caused hundreds of thousands of people to pour out of Myanmar into neighboring countries. Rohingya refugees are often neglected in the global conversation surrounding refugees, so today we investigate. What happens to Rohingya refugees after they escape from Myanmar? And how does a recent bilateral agreement between Bangladesh and Myanmar affect this refugee crisis? Before we get started, a brief warning. Some of the content of this piece references disturbing violence and may be upsetting to some listeners. Although the Rohingya have faded from the news, the struggles they face are still far from over. To help us understand the horrific journey the Rohingya face even after leaving Myanmar, I'm joined by War News Radio reporters Jiachun Teo and Jasmine Rashid. Welcome, Chun and Jasmine.
Hi, Serena.
Thank you for having us here.
So today, this story starts at Jasmine's Thanksgiving.
Like many families, Thanksgiving is a time for family, food, and politics. For me, the family consists of Bangladeshi immigrants and Italian New York natives. The food is a mix of delicious casserole and biryani. And this year, the political conversation kept circling back to one topic, the Rohingya crisis.
My name is Tanya Rashid, and I am a correspondent and producer.
Tanya recently flew to South Asia to cover the Rohingya crisis with PBS NewsHour. This was the first Thanksgiving she spent with us. Tanya and I actually met at a bar in New York City over the summer during a happy hour event for South Asian journalists. She bought me a drink, and I noticed her last name on the card, Rashid. We soon found out that our families are from the same district in Bangladesh. Long story short, we're probably long-lost cousins, and she's now a part of my family. And were definitely our ancestors' wildest dreams.
So Tanya, let's recount a bit about your experience in general reporting the crisis. What surprised you the most?
What was most shocking for me was to witness hundreds of thousands of women and children flooding in across the Myanmar border into Bangladesh. To me, that was the most harrowing moment because these people are the most vulnerable ones. And it wasn't just the mothers and children, it was also, I don't know how to describe it, but those makeshift things that they use bamboo to carry.
To carry the elderly. And
Yeah, the ones that couldn't walk.
And so what exactly made this kind of exodus so dangerous? What were the barriers they were facing?
Well, for one, I mean, I trekked a few miles into the border and I got a taste of what they go through, just a taste, which is, you know, mud. Thick mud, rain, heat, and then they're fleeing, desperately fleeing violence,
right?
So some people trekked through the jungle and the mountains for 15 days, others trekked 7 days. But for me, just walking a few miles was exhausting. Right. I can't imagine not having food and water in my belly and walking for 7-8 days.
The current situation on the Myanmar-Bangladesh border is horrific. Without context, it's hard to comprehend how we even got to this point.
In our last episode on the Rohingya crisis, we provided some historical and political reasons for why the Rohingya are being persecuted. Even knowing about the historical events leading up to now, it's still shocking how the human rights of the Rohingya are so clearly abused.
I agree. Besides the historical context, I think it's important to understand the current economic and political atmosphere that perpetuates violence and the refugee situation.
My name is Hamid Rashid. Senior Advisor, Chief of Service at the United Nations. And just to be clear that I'm here speaking here in a personal capacity. So my views here are completely my personal views, not the views of the UN or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or the Government of Bangladesh.
Hamid is my uncle, and he was also at my Thanksgiving dinner. As an economist, he's always acutely aware of the role global capitalism plays in shaping human rights crises. As he points out, there is nothing arbitrary about Rohingya, as one of the over 100 ethnic groups being singled out for persecution. The land they've historically lived on is both fertile and profitable. To the Myanmar government, they're in the way of some large potential economic gain.
The Rohingya crisis should not be seen as a, you know, religious conflict of, you know, two religions between the Buddhist and the Muslim minority in Myanmar. Of course, there's one component. This is, they belong to a different religious group compared to the majority religious practices in Myanmar. But that's only one aspect of it. There's also an economic dimension to it. Land grabbing is an important dimension. Cultural, racial dimension to it, because, you know, Rohingya people are darker skinned compared to the majority population in Myanmar. So there's there are multiple dimensions to this conflict. But also, you know, as an economist, I think its bottom line is economic. You know, there's huge, you know, incentive for these groups to basically to undermine the rights of the Rohingyas because someone benefits from that.
Aslan Ula, who we interviewed last time, was also very insistent that the Burmese government had ulterior economic motives to violently removing the Rohingya.
The Myanmar government actually declared Rakhine as a business hub. So they need to actually wipe out Rohingyas to start their business. And already, like, around 32 companies from Japan already invested. So the countries, those who are known to be upholding human rights, and they are also silent because they have already invested. So it means business is, you know, it's more important than humanity.
It seems like it would be hard to prove that one of a government's reasons for committing human rights violations is for economic gain. It just sounds so cruel. No one would admit that part of their reason for killing and plundering their own people is to build a business hub.
Yeah, they're not going to come forward and admit that kind of thing. We should note, though, the Rakhine state does sit on top of oil reserves, and that there are current plans by the Myanmar government to turn the Rakhine town Kyapkyu into a special economic zone, an area with fewer industry regulations with the aim of attracting international business. This, along with the historic ethnic cleansing, is a driving force for the exodus of Rohingya refugees.
Okay, let's talk about the Rohingya refugees. We often hear about the violence in Rakhine that drives them out, but rarely about what happens after they reach Bangladesh and beyond.
Even as we speak, there continues to be an outpouring of refugees from Myanmar into Bangladesh. They each face unique struggles. There are children and grandparents. Many are sick or injured, but they all experience similar horrific journeys. Tanya met with a lot of refugees throughout her time in Bangladesh and ended up writing an article on one woman, Dildar Begum.
So, Tanya, tell me, who is Dildar Begum?
Dildar Begum is one of the refugees who fled Myanmar in the middle of the night with her children and her husband, who is mentally ill. By the seventh day of her journey, her babies, two of her youngest babies, just 45 days old, died in her arms. The horror she had to encounter from fleeing the Myanmar military, witnessing other women getting raped, and then to seeing her babies die in her arms while trying to flee is just a harrowing example of how bad it is for the people there and why they're leaving. I mean, why would you just up and leave unless there's a grave risk coming after you in your life?
Right, and these are people who have been here for centuries.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, they've been around for centuries. This is their home, this is their land, but they're treated like they don't belong there. Instead, they're spread out into internment camps all throughout Myanmar. And the sad truth is that journalists aren't allowed in there because they will probably discover all the unjust things that are happening to them.
Wow.
All we get to see is them crossing the border and telling us what they're experiencing back there. And it's bizarre when you're standing there and they're telling you their stories and you just see smoke, black smoke from the, you know, from the clouds of the huts being burnt to ash.
Wow, Jasmine, that's just horrific.
The Bangladeshi government doesn't exactly have a safe haven for refugees either. Camps like Cox's Bazar have a large enough population to be small cities with almost none of the resource or infrastructure to maintain one. If they can afford to, many refugees leave Bangladesh for yet another country.
Our reporter, Chern, spoke with a nonprofit in Malaysia that deals with many Rohingya refugees.
Yeah, I became acquainted with the UNHCR and a number of nonprofits in Malaysia's capital, Kuala Lumpur, while filming a documentary on undocumented migrants at home this past summer. Most people in Malaysia and internationally are unaware of how major a destination Malaysia is for refugees. There are hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees that currently reside in Malaysia. Malaysia may be a preferable place of refuge than Bangladesh or their home in Myanmar, but Rohingya refugees in Malaysia face another set of difficult challenges. Here to tell us more is Deepa Nambiar from the nonprofit Asylum Access.
So Asylum Access is an international nonprofit refugee rights organization. What we do is we focus on improving refugee rights in host countries. So knowing fully well that most refugees can't return to their country of origin, and they can't be, or many of them are not going to be resettled to a third country. In terms of my role, I'm the country director, so I lead the operations here. It's a pretty small office. It's just four staff and a team of volunteers.
What makes Malaysia an attractive destination for Rohingyas?
It's really hard to tell, but Rohingyas have been coming to Malaysia since the 1980s, so it's really not a new phenomenon. And they've come, from what we've heard, for a really wide variety of reasons. Many of them have family here. So, as I mentioned, because they've been here sometimes for decades, their family members will come to Malaysia because they know that they've got networks here. Of course, another factor is geography. Refugees tend to move to countries closest to them. There is similarity in terms of religion. There are work opportunities, although not formal work opportunities, but refugees, for the most part, can easily find jobs in the informal sector, which is pretty exploitative. I mean, that's a whole different set of issues. But the fact is, for many of them, their lives here and the prospects here are going to be much better than what it is back home.
And how did they even get to Malaysia in the first place? For listeners unfamiliar with the geography, Malaysia borders neither Myanmar or Bangladesh.
Almost all of them are smuggled in. They take boats, oftentimes from Myanmar or Bangladesh into Thailand, and then they're smuggled through the Thai-Malaysia border. Some of them get passports, or fake passports, really, that allow them to travel by plane into Malaysia. And so, save for the very few of them that are able to afford that option, most of them go through the boat and overland option. And that is a very dangerous route. Many of them are trafficked. They are abused. Back in 2015, human trafficking graves were found along the Thai-Malaysia border with bodies of Rohingya refugees.
The Andaman Sea crisis was considered a disaster. After mass graves were discovered, the Thai and Malaysian governments decided to crack down on trafficking. But while trying to stop the trafficking, they ended up intercepting and turning away boats of thousands of refugees, and hundreds of refugees died.
Many rights groups knew this was happening along the Thai-Malaysia border for a really long time. But this really brought to the international spotlight the kind of horror that Rohingya refugees, just trying to flee their place to safety, have to go through. They're held for ransom, they are tortured and beaten and raped and abused in all sorts of ways until they're able to pay the money and then cross the border to Malaysia. So before they even get to Malaysia, many of them endure quite horrible journeys, and once they get to Malaysia, it's a whole other set of issues.
What kinds of issues are there?
So Malaysia has not ratified the 1951 Refugee Convention. There are no laws that protect refugees. And so basically what it means is that if you're a refugee in Malaysia, you're treated like any other undocumented person. And that means you're subject to arrest. They are regularly arrested by the police and immigration. They're kept in immigration detention centres. Conditions have been described as torture-like.
And Deepa also told me about her experience seeing a detention centre.
Overall, it's really bad. I think the average time that an individual spends in immigration detention centre is 14 months. And so you can imagine 14 months of being separated from your family and having very limited contact to the outside world is a horrible thing to have to go through. Many refugees are in there because they are not registered with the UNHCR yet. If they are registered with the UNHCR, most of the time they will be released at some point prior to entering a detention center.
So Chern, hold on. What does it mean to be registered with the UNHCR?
So, until you're formally registered with the UNHCR, you're not technically considered a refugee, but rather you're an asylum seeker. This means that you aren't afforded some of the protections of being a refugee. While Malaysia itself doesn't have any path for refugees to become legal residents, being a refugee can allow you to apply to be resettled in a third country that accepts refugees. As I found out when I spoke to Deepa Adil, it can be difficult to obtain a UNHCR card.
I mean, we've seen some Rohingyas who've been here for 6 years and who don't have a UNHCR card yet, who don't even have an appointment yet. And it's a pretty complex process because of the sheer numbers of Rohingyas in Malaysia and the UNHCR being a fairly small office in comparison. They find themselves in a position where they are unable to keep up with the number of applications, the number of asylum seekers who are requesting for UNHCR status. And so it isn't a streamlined process where they just approach the UNHCR office, get an appointment, go for an interview, get a card, and then get resettled. For Rohingyas, they were previously almost like group exercises conducted by the UNHCR where they go into communities and register them because they couldn't deal with, you know, having 20,000 Rohingyas, for example, at their doorstep. But they haven't been doing that in a long time. So Rohingyas at this point have very few access points to get registered with the UNHCR.
You mentioned that the UNHCR in Malaysia used to be like more proactive in going out into the communities to get people registered. Why do you think there's been a drop? Why have they been more passive now?
It's quite a few things, I think. One of it is the sheer numbers. We've got 60,000 Rohingyas that are registered with the UNHCR. I mean, estimates vary from 35,000 unregistered to over 100,000 unregistered Rohingyas. So I guess the first question is just pure logistics. How do we register that many people? A second issue is also issues of fraud. There are many people from Bangladesh who are not Rohingya, who claim to be Rohingya. And so, and where there are concerns around credibility, oftentimes that requires a more thorough interview. And that can be quite a lengthy process as well. And there are also the politics of it all. I mean, refugees are not always a very welcome topic for discussion. And if it is being discussed, it's not in a positive way. And this is, you know, our hypothesis. Sometimes there is that pressure from the government to not register so many refugees so as to keep the numbers somewhat controlled.
It's kind of my impression that even with a UNHCR card, it's still technically illegal to work. So why does that make it easier?
It is technically illegal. They still can be arrested. But the reality is that with a UN card, they have this informal protection from arrest. So the police officers are less likely to arrest them. They might take a bribe. Well, if you don't have a card, chances are you're probably going to be arrested and put into an immigration detention center for a long time before they arrange for your return to your country. Knowing this, employers are more likely to hire those with UNHCR cards. It just gives them that surety that they are less likely to lose their employees through arrest by a police officer.
What are the kinds of jobs that they normally end up working in? And who are the people who hire them?
So they work in sectors that are commonly referred to as dangerous, dirty, and demeaning. They work in markets, so they sell goods in the markets, or they're cleaners. They work in manufacturing, construction, so any job that requires manual labor. If you know of refugees who are working with employers who treat them very well, who pay their salaries, then many of them also hire them because, you know, they need workers, and also they know that their situation here is so bad, they want to help them, and that's why they give them jobs. But unfortunately, there's a large group of them that are not like that, and they really will take advantage of the situation.
And Deepa also spoke about their living conditions.
They stay in shared houses. So we've been to some apartments where there's 3 bedrooms and, you know, 4 families living there. So it's really very communal type setting. It's really just because rent is expensive and there's this very limited money to go around.
Wow. While it may be a step up from being violently attacked in Myanmar or living in crowded unsanitary camps in Bangladesh, the situation in Malaysia still sounds less than ideal. Without legal status, you literally can't do anything if your employer refuses to pay you or your landlord jacks up your rent. At least this is only a temporary stop before being resettled.
Well, actually, for many, many refugees, this becomes the new reality for them. There are far more refugees worldwide than other countries are willing to take in. Furthermore, countries can profile what refugees they want to take in, and it's hard to tell what this profile will be.
So as NGOs working with refugees, we don't really have a clear sense of what kinds of profiles country X are looking for resettlement. UNHCR has a better idea, but really these are decisions that are determined in the country that is resettling. There's only a handful of resettlement countries worldwide. So US, even now, I think they're still the highest country, even despite the massive cuts. They're still taking the most amount of refugees through their resettlement program. Some countries just flat out say, we don't want Rohingyas, and they can specify a very specific set of skills and a profile that they would like.
Right. And so what happens is oftentimes the most vulnerable and those who are educated and have special skills are the ones who get resettled. So especially for younger refugees and particularly young men or those who do unskilled labor, they may never get resettled. But would it be wrong to frame refugees as just victims? They do take initiative and form their own communities, right, Deepa? Could you explain a little bit more?
There's quite a few different community groups. Rohingya Society of Malaysia, there's a Rohingya Women's Development Network, there's five or six around Malaysia. Some groups, they try very hard to offer a lot of support to their community members. They issue community cards, good alternative to UNHCR cards, because many times it takes so long for them to get an interview with the UNHCR. They help with birth registration, sometimes even things like resolving domestic issues. They support them in terms of intervention for arrests. There's quite an interesting and dynamic community support structure.
So that is, in a broad nutshell, what life is like for a refugee in limbo. Neither home nor welcomed permanently in any other country.
So just a couple weeks ago, while we were producing this piece, in fact, it was announced that Myanmar and Bangladesh reached a bilateral deal. Myanmar agreed to allow the return of most of the Rohingya from the recent exodus.
And that may appear like a good thing. I mean, after all, the Rohingya people don't want to be in Bangladesh. Their home is in Myanmar.
But I think we all quickly realize that, like most things, it's a bit more complex than that. For starters, they didn't go through UNHCR, which probably means they're not planning on abiding by international guidelines. Secondly, there's no mention about whether the Rohingya will be safer when they do return to Myanmar.
So you're basically telling me it's like a game of hot potato, except with people? Like, maybe that's a bad analogy, but essentially neither Myanmar nor Bangladesh want them, so they keep trying to push them off to the other?
Yeah, kind of. I talked to my uncle and Tanya about this deal.
I don't know the specifics of this deal. I only read newspaper articles about it. And personally, I'm not very optimistic because this kind of deals are often the political statements. When it comes to actual implementation, one side can drag its feet. We saw that kind of agreements also in the 80s initially and also in the 90s when the first Rohingya crisis erupted. In recent years, in the last, say, 40 years. It would ultimately depend on the goodwill of not the Myanmar government per se, but the Myanmar military, because I think they ultimately call the shots there. They have moved to a democratic government, but still there's a power sharing between the democratically elected government and the military. I think that for the international community, it would be very important to put pressure on the military. What matters to them most is access to, you know, weapons. Countries like China and Russia, they have to play a more important proactive role to put pressure on Myanmar military. Also, some economic pressure would be very important. Myanmar just opened up, a lot of foreign investments are going in. And if they see this investment flows would stop or would be redirected to other countries, I think they'd also create some pressure on Myanmar business community to put pressure on the Myanmar military and the Myanmar political government. So I think we have a long way to go.
So Jasmine, why does there need to be pressure on both the democratic government and the military?
So those two are actually separate entities. There's a lot of attention on putting pressure on Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader of Myanmar. She's been stripped of various international awards and denounced by many. However, she has virtually no control over the military.
Wait, then who does?
That would be Min Aung Hlaing, who has escaped much of the spotlight surrounding this story. He has led the ethnic cleansing campaigns against the Rohingya and has historically done so against both them and other ethnic groups. Aung San Suu Kyi is definitely still guilty of staying silent, but the international community needs to strategically target Min Aung Hlaing and the military as well.
Otherwise, even if the Rohingya do return, the military is going to continue their actions, and they're happy to let Aung San Suu Kyi absorb all the criticism. But there's even more holes in this deal.
One of the caveats in the agreement is that they have to prove that they lived in Myanmar during the last 6 months, right, or they have to prove their citizenship. But it's very difficult for poor people, landless people who never have credit cards, who never have any kind of bank accounts, to prove that they are bona fide Myanmar citizens. They don't have national ID cards, they don't have social security numbers. So that's like, you know, that's the elephant in the room. You can say, okay, we'll take you back provided you prove this. But that's an almost an untenable condition. I think critically important issue is that to involve international neutral parties. It cannot be a bilateral issue, it cannot be dealt bilaterally. UN, International Red Cross, now other international humanitarian groups can be involved to have a verification process that is objective, that respects the rights of these people so that they can go back and out to their home. And there may be other mechanisms to verify. They can be asked questions about their village, what the village looked like, what shops, where was the market. So there's language test and other things can be done to verify their identity so that they can go back.
Essentially, the deal is all surface. Do you think it's to deflect international attention?
It very well could be.
To me, that's just doesn't make any sense. If there are people still fleeing, why are you trying to send them back?
Exactly.
And would they want to go back?
Exactly.
You know, why? Their huts and their farms have been burned to ash. Their women have been raped. The children are being thrown into pits of fire. It's like throwing them into the traumatic place that they escaped.
Right. Yeah. Hamid uncle was like, it's not gonna do anything. It's just kind of a formal thing to see, like, hey, see, we're doing something.
My hunch is they'll probably send like a few hundred and then maybe fabricate and say they sent thousands, because that happened in the past.
Yeah.
In the 1990s, I believe they did the same thing. Mm-hmm. They sent you back. And I don't know. It's just a very complicated situation. I don't know what the future holds in store for them.
I think part of this issue comes back to citizenship. If they're stateless, even in their own homes, there's still no protections for them, even if they're able to return.
Right. And their legal status at home isn't actually any better than it is in Bangladesh or Malaysia, or really anywhere else.
So I guess on that note, what can listeners do to help push this process of putting pressure on forward?
I think international conscience is, to some extent, in my view, is muted. We see newspaper articles in New York Times, thanks to New York Times. But that's, again, it's limited to, you know, the elites in New York and the East Coast. But I don't think the global conscience is missing. You know, if you're a U.S. citizen, putting pressure through your congressmen, through your senators can be very helpful, and writing letters, creating, you know, demonstrations, you know, in campuses. Again, this is under the radar to some extent, because there are so many other things happening globally. So this is one of those, you know, footnotes.
Right.
And I think
this idea of compassion fatigue.
Exactly, compassion fatigue, and we feel that if we have done enough, what else we can do?
Wait, Jasmine, can you explain what compassion fatigue is?
Yeah, so it's basically the idea that we can only expend so much energy on being compassionate towards others. The more we hear about terrible events around the world, the more we're likely to become numb and tired of listening to it, quite frankly.
I'm hopeful that, you know, college campuses and universities and intellectuals would do more, regardless of their religious affiliation or ethnicity or racial identity. You know, we should see them as human beings, and we should come forward as fellow human beings to support their cause.
But until the laws in Myanmar change, despite the amount of international outcry, the hopes of the Rohingya to return home safely remain bleak.
And for the hundreds of thousands of refugees scattered throughout Southeast Asia, their lives remain in limbo.
So until citizenship protections are provided to the Rohingya, this tragedy will likely continue for the foreseeable future. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. If you want to hear more pieces from us, find us on Facebook, Twitter, or visit our website at warnewsradio.org. This piece was produced by Jasmine Rashid, Jia Chun Teo, and myself, Serena Sung Clark, with help from Catherine Pemberton, Catherine Kwok, and Jake Scattle. Thank you to our guests, Tanya Rashid, Hamid Rashid, and Deepa Nambiar. For listeners, you can view Tanya's full video coverage at PBS NewsHour. The name of the piece is Flooding into Bangladesh, Rohingya Refugees Flee Harrowing Violence. Thank you for listening.